Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
You may be seated. Good afternoon. I'm Gisella Triana. I'm the Senior Judge here at Third Court of Appeals, and let me welcome you along with Justice Lopez Theofanis and Justice Crump to this 1:30 setting. I want to ask before we start a couple of things. I know that y'all are the same attorneys for both cases, right?
Yes, sir.
So are y'all okay? I know we set one for 1:30 and one for 2:30. Are y'all okay if we just go through the first one and then go through the second one without a break?
Yes,
but if there's a reason not to do it, then we're open to that. I'm not saying that's the way. I just thought maybe everybody would want to get out of here quicker.
Appellees are fine for that.
Is that okay? Okay, good. Couple of housekeeping matters. First of all, we are, this is being streamed live through our YouTube channel, so please smile into the camera. I'm not sure actually you can even see your faces in the camera because we have a pretty rudimentary setup, but and it will be on our website from now through posterity. If you ever want to go see yourself or listen to yourself, I hate listening to myself on tape, but if you want to, it's there. Timekeeping, we've got the lights, so please be aware of them. Green means you're good, yellow means you've got 2 minutes, and red means please stop. Of course, if you're in the middle of a sentence or a thought, feel free to finish what you're saying, but be mindful that it's time to stop. Have y'all divided the time into 15 minutes and then 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay, perfect. So then at this time, I'm going to go ahead and call both cases, if that's okay, which are 0324543, Murchison versus Next Frontier Holdings, Inc. and Benuvia, Inc., and 0324-00542 CV, Todd C. Davis versus Next Frontier Holdings, Inc. and Benuvia, Inc. If I could, well, first of all, is the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
And is the appellee ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
If you will please state your name and the parties that you represent at this time.
Michael Payne, and I represent Murchison LTD along with Shane McDowell.
And also?
And we also represent Todd.
Thank you.
Stephanie Michael on behalf of Next Frontier Holdings, Inc.
Okay, thank you all very much. Then at this time, if you're ready to proceed, Mr. Payne, you may approach the podium.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Payne, and I, along with Shane McDonald, represent in this matter Murchison LTD. We also represent Todd Davis. We also represent a defendant in the underlying matter, Benuvia Holdings. Murchison seeks the reversal today of the trial court's decision finding that personal jurisdiction exists over Murchison, a Canadian company. Later today, the court will also hear arguments regarding personal jurisdiction over Mr. Todd Davis, a Florida resident. While plaintiffs initially alleged general and specific jurisdiction over Murchison, plaintiffs conceded that there is no general jurisdiction over Murchison or Mr. Davis at the June 17, 2024 evidentiary hearing. Plaintiffs concede at this point because there's no findings, there's no basis to demonstrate that either of these defendants would be considered at home in Texas. Without being able to demonstrate general jurisdiction over the defendant Murchison, plaintiffs argue that Texas can exercise specific jurisdiction over the defendant Murchison. I want to start with some really important, I think, undisputed facts related to this lawsuit. There are two foreign plaintiffs in this matter who have brought suit originally against six foreign defendants for claims of fraud, negligent misrepresentation, breach of fiduciary duty, tortious interference, and conspiracy. None of the parties are Texas residents, including the plaintiffs. Not one of the eight parties that were originally sued in this lawsuit have a meaningful connection to the state of Texas. In fact, plaintiffs are not even registered to conduct business in the state of Texas. This doesn't just impact their legal ability or their capacity to bring this lawsuit, but it also demonstrates the lack of any substantial connection or nexus between even the plaintiffs and the state of Texas. It's also important to note that defendants Canvalade and Marilyn Martin have both been dismissed in this lawsuit already. Judge Kennan and Cavalante is actually a $5 million investor in Vonovia. They've actually been dismissed in this lawsuit for lack of jurisdiction. And then Marilyn Martin, who was actually an employee of Next Frontier, has also already been dismissed in this litigation for lack of jurisdiction. And I think those are some important points to begin with as we look at and determine whether or not Texas has jurisdiction over this litigation and these parties. The plaintiff bears the initial burden of pleading sufficient allegations to bring a non-resident defendant within the provisions of the Texas long-arm statute. And this burden shifting, then generally, there is an exception that's very applicable in this case, but generally then, once that's done, the burden shifts to the defendants for us to negate only the basis for jurisdiction that are apparent from the pleadings on file at the time the special appearance is heard. And I think that's important for us to look at here is what are those specific allegations in the pleadings at the time the special appearance is heard. In the briefing, we've seen different arguments and different theories advanced that are not identified in the pleadings. And after negating the basis, so the defendants are then required to put on proofs to negate that evidence, and then the plaintiffs, the burden shifts back for them to demonstrate that there is jurisdiction. It's our position that not only did Murchison negate each of the alleged jurisdictional elements or the claims that the plaintiffs made, but that as it relates to the pleadings, and there was two pleadings here, there was an initial pleading, we filed our motions for special appearance to dismiss, and then the plaintiffs had the opportunity to amend, which they did, and they still were not able to allege specific allegations related to Murchison that identify jurisdictional components here. And so they also conducted discovery, which we consented to and provided that discovery. Plaintiffs have never met their initial burden of even demonstrating or establishing jurisdiction from their pleadings as it relates to Murchison. The basis that they've identified as it relates to Murchison, the only jurisdictional basis that we glean from the plaintiff's pleading is this idea of an alter ego theory. And I did indicate that there is one exception. This is the exception to that burden shifting. In this particular claim, a claim of alter ego is one of the exceptions to the general rule, such that the plaintiffs have to actually prove alter ego before the burden shifts to the defendants. And that's the Hoffman versus Dunhart case that we cited in our reply brief. And also the ATIC versus Code Techno Group case, which clearly indicate that. And here, plaintiffs have not proved alter ego. They've repeated over and over that Murchison somehow controlled Vonovia Holdings. That word is just repeated, controlled. But there's no proof, much less a description, of how Murchison controlled Vonovia Holdings.
Can you tell me, Mr. Payne, what was Murchison's role in or involvement in the Vonovia acquisition?
Yeah, Murchison, I think that can be described by what they are, right? And so their role in this transaction was they didn't have a role. What Murchison is they are advisors to investors in these issues. And so what their role is they do due diligence on transactions. They look at, they don't own any assets, and in this case, right, they said that there's this issue of a secured note that's owed to Murchison. Murchison is not a party to any of these transactions, is not identified in any of the documents, owns none of these assets, and never owned any of these assets, and had no role other than an advisory role.
Who are the indirect shareholders that Murchison acts as a sub-advisor to?
Those would be the shareholders of entities like Vonovia.
All of the shareholders?
Some of the shareholders. And they only serve as a kind of a due diligence advisory role. They didn't participate in any aspect of this transaction. As the pleadings indicate, Murchison made no representations, kind of that idea of the misrepresentations. What did they say? Who said it? There's no allegations related to any statement made by Murchison because Murchison wasn't involved in this transaction.
Okay, so then why did, and is it Mr. Liechtenstein?
Yes.
Why did he visit the Round Rock facility then?
And that...
After Benuvia Holdings had acquired.
After. So after the UCC sale in August of 2022, again, Murchison's role is to advise the shareholders of due diligence issues, right? Inspections of facilities. Is there an operation there? Is it ongoing? What is what's going on at this facility? They didn't direct, they don't manage, they don't have any employees. And so Mr. Liechtenstein's visit, I think, is clearly identified in his declaration, was he came to determine whether or not, and to the extent that there's an operation going on at the facilities. He took no other roles. And I think that that's a really good question, because during the operative time period that we're looking at here, from this kind of claim by claim analysis, for instance, with issues related to the tortious interference, right? How could, and when we look at this claim by claim analysis, plaintiffs claim that the defendants interfered with their potential mergers with Pono Capital and Jupiter Wellness. And when we look at what the pleadings say and what the declarations indicate, there's no allegation or any evidence to the effect that Murchison did anything in Texas to get in the way of any merger or repayment of the secured note. And as you point out, this visit after the UCC sale in August of 2022, that obviously didn't take time in a period. There was no Murchison contact individuals, no representatives in the state of Texas during the time period in which the allegation for the tortious interference could take place. From a timing perspective, that would be December 8th of 2021. Through that time period, when they say that they're tortiously interfered with the second Pono Capital, which terminated on August 8th of 2022. During that time period, there was no representative Murchison who made any communications, contact, or ever appeared in the state of Texas.
Did Murchison communicate with Davis or any of the other defendants about the reacquisition before it happened?
There's nothing in the record that indicates that Murchison had any involvement with the UCC sale or the reacquisition of the assets.
There is an allegation, though, that Murchison was owed under the note, and your client disputes that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I think if we look at that senior secured note, the allegation that Murchison is owed money under that note is incorrect. It's inaccurate. Plaintiffs themselves concede that Murchison is not a party to the secured note. That is on their brief, page 16. Also, we have in the clerk's file on page 1058 through 67 is actually the secured note. Murchison is not a party to it. They're not a lender here. There's no allegations that they are owed any money under the secured note. And the reason why is because they're not. They have no interactions with the secured note. And so the fact that there's an allegation that somehow Murchison is owed money in this case is conclusory. There's no basis for it.
But it is a sworn statement, correct?
The statement is by the plaintiff's former, I believe, CEO, Shannon Sokwe. And I believe that his statements, when you review those declarations, as we've identified in our briefing, those are conclusory statements. Saying something like they committed, that they're owed money under the secured note. There's no information that he provides of a concrete basis indicating how we owe money, why we would owe money, why we're not a party to that note. And so, yes, his statement is sworn under the penalty of perjury, but it's conclusory and does not indicate that Murchison actually is a party to this transaction, is a party to the secured note, nor are they owed any money in this transaction.
So just to sort of follow up on that, are you challenging the trial court's implied findings then?
We are, yes. When we look at this record as a whole, the implied findings would be based upon evidence or information in the case. And so when we look at this, we are indicating that the statements of Shannon Sokwe are conclusory and did nothing to prove. And I think we briefed some of those cases in which we say that's not information that can be relied on to determine jurisdiction. Some of the other, I want to go back and do that case-by-case analysis. For instance, as it would relate, we've talked about the secured note. I think there's also another important aspect to identify about the secured note. This idea of purposeful availment in Texas, the secured note itself indicates that any litigation related to that should be conducted in New York, which also indicates that the parties didn't intend to litigate in Texas. They actually intended to litigate in New York. There actually has been a lawsuit in New York with these same plaintiff and defendant, Next Frontier Capital, in which a $26 million judgment has been entered against Next Frontier. And so there has been litigation. After that litigation was concluded, this lawsuit was filed in Texas based upon their claims of a tort theory. And so the secured note itself does indicate that the proper forum for this litigation would be in New York. There's also this the conspiracy.
And Murchison is part of that litigation?
They are not.
Okay.
No, they are not part of that. That was part of the transaction, which includes suing on the secured note. And Murchison is not a party to any of that litigation because they're not included in it. They're owed no money. They didn't participate in the transaction. They're not identified in any of the operative documents related to the transaction, the underlying transaction. The conspiracy and claim that's based upon a conspiracy, Dr. Agarwal has not yet been served in this case, but that goes to back to the same type of theory that is the underlying tort, and that would be the tortious interference in which Murchison was not here, conducted no communications, never stepped foot in Texas during that time period in which they're alleging there's been interference. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. And is it Michelle? Miss Michael, I apologize.
No.
I should have paid attention when you made your announcement. You may proceed, Miss Michael.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin by clarifying three quick points. First, we are asking this court to affirm the trial court's decision based on Murchison's individual contacts with Texas, not an alter ego theory. Because of that, this court does not even need to address this theory that Murchison was the alter ego of Panuvia Holdings, because these direct contacts with Texas are independently sufficient to support jurisdiction. And those individual contacts include Murchison's role in the Panuvia acquisition, its trips to the Round Rock facilities, and its participation in this scheme to repossess Texas property. Second, Mr. Payne talked a lot about how there was nothing in the record supporting our allegations. One, we disagree with that, but beyond that, plaintiffs had zero obligation to present any evidence supporting our jurisdictional allegations because Murchison never met its own burden under the Texas Supreme Court's burden-shifting framework for personal jurisdiction. Under that framework, after we pleaded sufficient allegations to invoke jurisdiction over Murchison, the burden shifted to Murchison to present evidence negating every basis of pleaded jurisdiction. It did not do so here, so the burden never shifted back to us to present any evidence supporting our allegations. But even if it had, we presented ample evidence supporting those allegations that even if the burden had come to us, there would be fact issues on that evidence that this court must defer to on appeal. Third, To that end, as the court focused on today, there is conflicting evidence as to whether Murchison was owed the note. The evidence in the record shows that Mr. Soke did make a statement under oath that Murchison was owed the note. In response, Murchison's evidence that it presented in its special appearance, the declaration of Mr. Zogala, its portfolio manager, was completely silent as to the note. So they presented no evidence negating our allegations. And even if they had, Mr. Soke's sworn statement would be sufficient to provide evidence supporting that implied finding.
What about the note itself? Does that not contradict the finding?
Yes, the note itself does contradict the finding because Murchison is not an official party to the note. We've never contended that Murchison was an official party to that note. What we have contended is that Murchison is indirectly owed that note based on its involvement in this larger transaction.
Are there any details in the record that would help us understand that relationship?
What we currently have in the record is the testimony from Mr. Soke confirming that the note was owed to Murchison, as well as the admitted visit that Murchison's representative took to the Round Rock facilities following the Sham UCC sale. Had Murchison had no involvement with this transaction, it would have had no reason to go back to those facilities afterwards. So we contend that that also provides evidence of the note.
Do you have any other documentary evidence that you can point that supports your allegations that Murchison controls Panuvia Holdings?
So we also have the testimony of Mr. Soke on that point. He has personal knowledge of the facts giving rise to this litigation because he was the party for plaintiffs that was involved in these negotiations. So he was working with Murchison and could tell, based on his personal knowledge, he believed that Murchison was controlling Panuvia Holdings. But to get away from that, this court, we understand that there are difficulties with this alter ego and control theory, which is why we are asking the court to affirm based on Murchison's individual contacts. And we heard today that Murchison does not believe that we pleaded these individual contacts. But in Murchison's special appearance, it specifically acknowledged that plaintiffs had pleaded that Murchison made trips to the Round Rock facilities, that it had made misrepresentations to plaintiffs, and was involved in this larger transaction. So those allegations were not buried in the petition, and Murchison had the burden to negate them. Because it did not present any evidence supporting them, that ends the analysis.
Those trips were made by whom?
Mr. Zogala is Murchison's portfolio manager. He traveled to the Round Rock facilities the week that the Panuvia acquisition closed. The entire week, Mr. Davis was there as well. This is when everyone was at the Round Rock facilities for this closing. And then several months after the UCC sale, another employee from Murchison revisited.
So those visits in and of themselves wouldn't constitute anything nefarious. Mm-hmm. So what contacts with Texas are specific to the claims in the case? I mean, what are you saying that Murchison did specifically?
In the petition, we allege that Murchison made misrepresentations to plaintiffs regarding the Panuvia acquisition. So that trip to Texas the week that the Panuvia acquisition closed plays into that. Under the Texas Supreme Court's decision in Moncrief, the fact that non-resident defendants traveled to Texas in regards to the transaction underlying the litigation is sufficient to show that they made a business contact with Texas to support jurisdiction. Even if, as here, the non-resident defendant disputes the purpose of that visit. The Texas Supreme Court has said that the defendant's subjective intent is irrelevant. The fact that they made that contact with Texas suffices.
But what representations are y'all alleging are false that were specifically made before the Panuvia acquisition by merchants?
So we alleged that several misrepresentations were made. We alleged that the defendants, including Murchison, misrepresented that we would be entitled to run Panuvia. We also alleged that Murchison and the other defendants misrepresented that financing and debt matters would not be discussed with Mr. Agarwal. Now, this was that one was after the Panuvia acquisition closed. Okay. There is precedent saying that we were not required to set forth every alleged misrepresentation that was made at this stage. We alleged in the petition that they made misrepresentations, and they presented no evidence even addressing those arguments, much less negating them. So that satisfied our burden.
And are y'all alleging that the scheme to sell and reacquire began before the actual acquisition, or was this something that you believe, your clients believe, came up after the acquisition?
Yes, so we've alleged fraudulent inducement in addition to fraud. So our claims begin arising in the lead up to the Benuvia acquisition, all the way through after the sham UCC sale. And that leads back to a point that Mr. Payne touched on earlier. And then he says that the relevant time frame for our claims is December 8th, when this acquisition closed, and August 18th, when we lost possession of BMI, BT, and the Round Rock facilities. That's just an attempt to artificially narrow the timeline of this case to get around the fact that Murchison was not physically in Texas in that time. So you can't artificially narrow the timeline to avoid jurisdiction, but beyond that, Texas law is clear that physical presence in Texas is not required to establish specific personal jurisdiction. Defendants can make contacts with Texas from outside of Texas. What matters is whether they are purposefully availing themselves of the privileges of doing business here, and that is what Murchison did by involving itself in this transaction, coming to Texas in relation to it, and having an economic interest in these Round Rock facilities that it had before the sale and then after the sham UCC sale.
I had a little bit of a hard time understanding the first misrepresentation related to what specifically?
The first misrepresentation that we alleged was that plaintiffs would be entitled to run Benuvia when they really had this scheme from the beginning that they were just going to take it back over. So it was just a temporary arrangement.
And is there anything in the record that supports that Murchison did any of those or made any of those misrepresentations?
So we did not present evidence specifically on that point because the burden never shifted back to us to present evidence substantiating our allegations.
Okay.
Because Murchison's individual contacts are really what drive the jurisdictional analysis here, I thought it might be helpful to walk through what we alleged in the petition one by one. Just as an aside, in this court's decision in Innis and other recent Court of Appeals cases throughout Texas, courts have made it clear that the petition as well as the special appearance response are properly considered in assessing the plaintiff's initial burden. And that's a very low threshold. Courts have held that alleging so much as a defendant has committed a tort in Texas is enough to carry the initial burden. So we pleaded far more than that in the petition. We pleaded that Murchison had at least four individual contacts with Texas that supported jurisdiction here. And these pleaded contacts, again, are the ones that govern the analysis because those are the ones that Murchison had the burden of negating under Texas law. So here, in addition to pleading that Murchison committed a tort in Texas and that the underlying offenses here all occurred in whole or in part in Texas, we alleged that Murchison had at least four contacts. First, we allege that this case implicates Texas real property and business operations in Texas. This case arises from plaintiff's purchase of BMI and BT and their interest in the Round Rock facilities. It's undisputed that BMI and BT have that interest in the Round Rock facilities and that those facilities operations are what drove all of the underlying transactions here.
And can you explain to me how exactly your real property claims that you're alleging, I mean, because the buildings are leased, correct?
Correct.
So can you explain to me the real property allegations?
Yes, Your Honor. So under Texas law, as Murchison agrees, a leasehold interest still constitutes a real property interest. And because BMI and BT are effectively asset holding entities, and some of the assets that they hold are this leasehold interest in the facilities, and which gives them the right to benefit from the operations of these facilities. The reason that the distinction between the leasehold and outright ownership wasn't raised initially is because no one had made that distinction until Murchison's reply brief. Until then, everyone had agreed, in Murchison's own words, that the claims here arose from plaintiff's acquisition of two pharmaceutical manufacturing facilities. So up until the very end of this appeal, everyone agreed that these facilities and their operations were the only things that gave value to the transactions that were at issue here. Because of that, the Texas real property and their Texas operations are central to all of plaintiff's claims. Second, plaintiffs allege that Murchison was involved in the sale of BMI, BT, and their interest in the Round Rock facilities to plaintiffs. Far from negating that contact, Murchison admitted twice that it played a role in that sale, perhaps three times, because today it still agrees that it played a role in the diligence of this transaction, and we allege that we were fraudulently induced into this transaction based on misrepresentations that were made in that process. The trial court could have reasonably concluded that that involved things that were said in due diligence and in these meetings that Murchison had in Texas. Beyond that, Murchison never presented any evidence negating our allegations that it made misrepresentations to plaintiffs regarding this sale, or that Murchison had an economic interest in the Round Rock facilities. Third, plaintiffs allege that Murchison traveled to and from Texas in connection with the sale. Murchison again has admitted this fact, although Mr. Zogala's declaration says that he was not in Texas to prepare and finalize the Benuvia acquisition. Nowhere does it dispute that he met with plaintiffs during that time. In addition, their responses in discovery explicitly stated that they had traveled to Texas in connection with plaintiffs' purchase of BMI and BT. So even if Mr. Zogala's declaration created a fact issue on that, their admissions in discovery constitute sufficient evidence that support the trial court's implied finding. Fourth, plaintiffs allege that Murchison visited the Round Rock facilities after defendants had wrongly repossessed them. Plaintiffs allege that the repossession was triggered by Murchison and the other defendants forcing a default on this note, which then triggered the repossession. Murchison presented no evidence, again, negating plaintiffs' allegations on that point. And we had also alleged that Murchison was involved with the forbearance agreement, which is what was ultimately used to then force the default. We had an agreement where we believed that the payments would be deferred and restructured, and the defendants went back on that in order to force this default. Mr. Zogala's declaration, again, says nothing about the note nor the forbearance agreement, so they did not meet their burden on that contact either. Murchison's admitted trip back to the Round Rock facilities following the sham UCC sale merely confirms that Murchison was individually involved with this fraudulent scheme from beginning to end. That brings us to applying these contacts to the personal jurisdiction framework. Texas courts can exercise personal jurisdiction over Murchison if it's authorized by the Texas long-arm statute and consistent with due process guarantees. The trial court correctly concluded that both of those requirements were met here. So as we've touched on, plaintiff's initial burden was very light. All we had to do was allege that Murchison committed a tort in Texas, and we did that here. But even if that allegation was insufficient, which it was not, all the other allegations we made regarding Murchison's individual contacts, including his trips to Texas and his role in the Benuvia acquisition, would have been more than sufficient to carry this burden. That shifted the burden to Murchison to negate every pleaded basis of jurisdiction. To carry that burden, Murchison had to show that it lacked minimum contacts with Texas, and it did not do so here. For one, Murchison failed to show that it did not purposefully avail itself of the privileges of doing business in Texas. Murchison did not even attempt to address most of plaintiff's jurisdictional allegations. For example, as touched on before, Murchison presented no evidence refuting plaintiff's allegations that Murchison had an economic interest in the Round Rock facilities and the Benuvia acquisition, that it was involved in that sale and the subsequent scheme to repossess the Texas assets, that it communicated with people in Texas regarding that scheme, that it traveled to the Round Rock facilities in that time frame, and that it was owed and manufactured a breach of the note. Each of those allegations is sufficient under Texas law to support jurisdiction, because under Texas law, purposeful availment can exist if a defendant seeks to reap the benefits of the Texas economy or engages in business operations here, if a defendant visits Texas to meet with others regarding the transactions underlying the litigation, a defendant has an interest in real property, or a defendant participates with others to repossess Texas property. Murchison's alleged conduct here satisfies each of those tests, so its failure to negate each and every one of these pleaded bases for jurisdiction requires affirmance. On the second prong of the minimum contacts analysis, the trial court also properly held that each of plaintiff's claims arose from or related to Murchison's contacts with Texas. Contrary to Murchison's contentions, this doesn't have to be assessed on a claim-by-claim basis because all of plaintiff's claims arose from the same forum contacts here. In Murchison's own words, in his brief, all the claims, and I quote, relate to plaintiff's acquisition of two pharmaceutical manufacturing facilities, end quote. Murchison's contacts with those facilities and the transactions involving the initial sale to plaintiffs and their subsequent repossession thus all relate to the same contacts. So unless the court has questions about the individual claims, I'll move to the final prong of the assessment. Thank you. So under the final step of the jurisdictional analysis, the court considers whether jurisdiction is consistent with the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. When, as here, the non-resident defendant has the minimum contacts with Texas, the exercise of personal jurisdiction will rarely not comport with these traditional notions. Murchison bears the burden of presenting a compelling case, in the Texas Supreme Court's words, that this is one of those rare instances, and it cannot carry that burden here. There's three factors under the Texas Supreme Court's precedent that is relevant to this assessment. First, litigating this suit in Texas would not unreasonably burden Murchison. Although Murchison disagrees, Texas law is clear that distance alone is generally insufficient to negate jurisdiction. If it was, Texas would never have personal jurisdiction over a non-forum defendant because they all have to travel to Texas. Second, Texas has a significant interest in this case because not only does it implicate Texas real property and business operations in Texas, but it also implicates torts that were committed within Texas. Finally, Texas is a convenient and effective forum for plaintiffs. This case centers around plaintiffs' acquisition and loss of the Round Rock facilities, so Texas is at the epicenter of all the claims and is thus a logical forum for plaintiffs. Perhaps even more importantly, though, the underlying Texas litigation is still proceeding against Murchison's co-defendant, Benuvia Holdings. Benuvia Holdings had originally appealed the trial court's denial of its special appearance, but voluntarily dismissed that appeal. So this litigation will be going in Texas with or without Murchison, and it furthers judicial economy to resolve the claims against both of those defendants in the same forum. As a result, there's no compelling reason that the exercise of jurisdiction here would be unreasonable. And for these reasons, and all the other reasons set forth in our briefing, we request that this court affirm the trial court's denial of Murchison's special appearance. If the court has no further questions, I'll cede the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Mark.
Thank you.
Mr. Payne.
May I proceed?
Yes.
I want to address that last point about that the litigation is going to proceed regardless in the state of Texas. Because Benuvia Holdings has withdrawn its appeal. The reality is Benuvia Holdings is a party to these contract documents in this case. The contract documents, including the forbearance agreement, the secured note, and all the other operative documents, contains forum selection clauses and venue clauses. And so jurisdiction is not necessarily the issue related to Benuvia Holdings because we do not believe that this litigation will be going forward in Texas as it relates to Benuvia Holdings. The parties here specifically indicated that they agreed that any of the litigation related to this transaction was to happen in New York. And Benuvia Holdings is a party to those documents, as is the plaintiff in this case.
And your hearing on forum has not yet taken place.
That has not taken place, Your Honor. Yes. And so we disagree that this litigation, that last factor, that this litigation is going to continue in Texas. We do not believe that or agree that that's going to happen because of the forum selection clauses that are even before this court. I do want to walk through the issue that I think is overlooked here related to the specific context of Murchison. And the court's questions related to, well, what statement did Murchison make? When did they make this statement? To whom did they make this statement? They didn't allege that. They didn't initiate that. They didn't indicate that Murchison has said or done anything in this case. It's because they didn't. And so there's nothing in the court record that indicates that Murchison made a misrepresentation. And that's the resistance to doing this case-by-case or claim-by-claim analysis, is because when you look at that, right, appearing at a UCC, after a UCC sale, how would that have any reference or relate to a fraud in the inducement claim? right? It took place months after. When we look at the tortious interference claim, how would the time period in which they claim that we have tortiously interfered with their contracts, there's no evidence or allegation that Murchison made any representation, ever came to Texas, or communicated with anyone. That tortious interference, it had to be during the time period in which the plaintiff was interacting with those two potential purchasers, Pono Capital and Jupiter Wellness. The undisputed evidence indicates from Murchison that they never communicated with anyone at the plaintiffs during that time period. But they've never stepped foot in Texas. They've never done anything during that time period.
But what about the allegations that the one misrepresentation I heard Ms. Michael talk about, that the plaintiffs would be able to run Vonovia, which was as to the inducement, not as to tortious interference?
Yes, and our question related to that is who made that claim, right? Who said that? When was that said? The fact that there's the second one wasn't in the right time period to help them on their fraud and the inducement claim. The claim indicates that I think that the comment was that they were going to be allowed to run Vonovia. That doesn't identify the operative facts of any of their claims. How does that go into their fraud claim, right? Their CEO is a co-defendant in this case, right? He was the one who, after the sale, he was appointed as their CEO in January of 2022 and was terminated in March of 2022, right? So that conspiracy time frame also would have to just be limited to that time period in which Mr. Agarwal was the CEO, their CEO. Because a conspiracy theory, there has to be some conspiracy, there has to be some communication. And in the record, it is clear that Murchison did not ever have any communication. In fact, the testimony is that they've never spoke with Mr. Agarwal. They've never met with Mr. Agarwal. They've never met with him, certainly in Texas, which is what the basis of a conspiracy would be. All of those things would have to be present as it relates to identifying the conspiracy. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Any questions? Okay. Then I'm going to go ahead and submit 03-24-543 CV, Murchison LTD versus Next Frontier Holdings, Inc. and Vonovia, Inc. And then, Mr. Payne, if you are okay with proceeding and not waiting at this time, then let's go ahead and go on with Totsie Davis versus Next Frontier Holdings.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Are you okay? Okay. Thank
you. May it please the court?
Yes.
As I pointed out in our prior argument.
Sorry, are we dividing the time the same?
That's fine. Thank you, Your Honor. As with Murchison, plaintiffs have abandoned their claim of general jurisdiction, and so we're only looking at specific jurisdiction. There is no basis to hold Mr. Davis as at home in Texas. A brief background of the summary of the key events related to this business dispute between the plaintiff, Next Frontier Holding, and Vonovia, Inc., and the defendant, Todd Davis, I think is helpful. The formation of Vonovia Holdings. Vonovia Holding was formed on December 15th of 2020 as a Delaware limited liability company with its principal place of business in Jupiter, Florida. Todd Davis has served as the officer and manager of Vonovia Holdings since its formation, a company. Prior to any of the allegations in this matter, a company was existing. Mr. Davis's residency. Mr. Davis is a resident of Jupiter, Florida, has had no personal or business connections with the state of Texas. He has never lived in Texas. He has never owned any property in Texas. He has never maintained an office in Texas. He has not conducted business in the state of Texas in his individual capacity. The Vonovia acquisition. On December 8th of 2021, Next Frontier acquired Vonovia Manufacturing and Vonovia Therapeutics from Vonovia Holdings. The acquisition involved a purchase of approximately, the purchase price was $44.9 million, and then there was a financing agreement through a secured promissory note, which we heard earlier. Mr. Davis signed these agreements on behalf of Benuvia Holdings. He was not a party to these documents. He was not a party to this transaction. He was simply serving in his corporate capacity. There was a default on the secured note. Next Frontier defaulted on the secured note shortly after the acquisition. Benuvia Holding issued a notice of default and acceleration and eventually conducted a public sale of the collateral pledge by Next Frontier. The New York lawsuit was filed. Benuvia Holdings filed the New York lawsuit against Next Frontier, seeking the deficiency balance under the secured note. Mr. Davis nor Murchison were a party to those lawsuits either. After that happened, plaintiffs filed this lawsuit in Williamson County, Texas. This included all of these different types of claims, tort-based claims. Fraud in the inducement, tortious interference, conspiracy, breach of a fiduciary duty, of which there's no allegation, certainly, that Mr. Davis had a fiduciary duty, and knowing participation in a breach of a fiduciary duty. And again, that timing is going to be very critical as we walk through this, when communications are alleged and when they aren't. And that's why we focus on this need to do a claim-by-claim analysis as to each defendant, because alleging that there was a contact or a communication 5 months after a fraud in the inducement case cannot serve as a basis for the fraud in the inducement. I've identified that the claims were against other defendants, two of them whom have already been dismissed, who had what I would certainly characterize as greater impact in this case. Cavallate was an actual investor in Benuvia of $5 million. They were dismissed. Marilyn Martin was actually a employee of Next Frontier who was working, pursuant to the allegations, with Dr. Agrawal on this conspiracy. She was also dismissed, a Colorado resident. The key points here that I would like to make as it relates to Mr. Davis before we do the claim-by-claim analysis is how to determine specific jurisdiction over a corporate representative. And that's really what Mr. Davis is here. He is a corporate representative, and all of the conduct and actions that he took was related to his corporate capacity.
But doesn't the fact that these claims involve torts undermine the corporate identity theory?
That they involve torts? Again, we have to look and see what specific allegations are made related to, for instance, a statement made by Mr. Davis, right, related to the fraud and the inducement, or looking at and saying, no, there's general allegations that lump three defendants or more together and say generally they committed a tort, right, for fraud, they committed a tort. There's no indication and there's no evidence in the record related to what was specifically said related to the tort, or that there was any communications with Dr. Agrawal related to certain issues, like his fiduciary capacity. There's testimony from the defendant in this case that those communications didn't take place, right? He didn't have a fiduciary, Mr. Davis didn't have a fiduciary duty, and certainly the fiduciary duty that Dr. Agrawal may have had related to the plaintiff it is not an operative fact as to a claim or an allegation related to a contact with us. What Mr. Davis did in his corporate capacity does not count as his contacts personally to identify jurisdiction. And I think, Your Honor, this fiduciary shield doctrine is what was discussed in Atik versus Co-Techno Group. And that's what's cited in the brief. The one exception to that is an alter ego, right? And maybe that's where the court asked, and I apologize if I didn't answer that correctly, but to impute a company's contacts onto an officer in his individual capacity, the plaintiff must allege and prove that the corporation is the individual's alter ego. Similar to Murchison, that's not been pled here. And there's no facts to suggest that Mr. Davis is the alter ego of Benuvia.
Does he have an ownership interest in Manubia Holdings?
I have to look at his statement. I do not believe that he has a direct ownership interest in Manubia Holdings. I can look at his declaration, but I don't believe that he has a direct ownership interest in Manubia Holdings. To impute a company's contacts into an officer his individual capacity, the plaintiff must allege and prove this alter ego. This was made very clear in the case, I think it's Leesboro Corp versus Hendrickson. We cite to this multiple times in our brief, where the court found that a corporate representative's non-tortious acts on the corporation's behalf don't constitute a contact for the purpose of personal jurisdiction. This is important here because plaintiff emphasized the number of trips, for instance, that Mr. Davis made to Texas, the number of communications he had with Dr. Agarwal, the number of employees he managed and directed, and make general allegations about his involvement with Manubia acquisition. But none of these are relevant until it's shown that those particular things involve tortious activity. For instance, that he managed and directed employees in Texas, that has nothing to do with the operative facts of this litigation, right? That isn't a contact specific to this case that would identify that he individually has jurisdiction, that there's jurisdiction here. Mr. Davis is not required to negate all of these non-tortious, what the plaintiffs have called Texas-centric allegations, because they are not relevant to specific jurisdiction analysis in this case. Additionally,
but Mr. aren't they enough to for purposeful availment? I mean, can't you argue that the plaintiffs have introduced evidence that he was his communications with Agarwal, who obviously he knew was Texas-based CEO, about the financial matters, plaintiff's financial matters, that's enough to show purposeful availment?
No, we look at that, one, that purposeful availment, right? Those comments or communications that Mr. Davis had with Dr. Agarwal as pled, Mr. Davis wasn't in Texas during those communications or statements, right? And so what we're looking at is statements or communications directed to an individual who potentially is in Texas. The only evidence here is that Dr. Agarwal was Texas-based, meaning that when he became the CEO for that period from January of 2022 to March of 2022, that couple of months period, that he potentially was based here in Texas. And we cite to the case law that identifies it started with telephone calls, right? That if a defendant in Jupiter, Florida calls a Texas resident, right, the telephone used to be able to say you could see where you're calling because the number that you called was based in Texas. And the court said, we've stepped back from that because with the use of mobile phones, we have no idea where people are at related to that. Email, the same analysis in the line of cases that we provided in our brief indicate that as well. Here, the testimony from Mr. Davis was, I wasn't directing any communication to Mr. Agarwal specifically related to the state of Texas. I didn't care where Mr. Agarwal was at. It didn't matter to us. We weren't purposefully availing myself if he was in Australia.
But
right?
He knew, Mr. Davis says he knew that he was based in Texas.
He knew that he was based in Texas, right,
correct,
for that time period. So that would relate to the claims only related to a conspiracy, right? Because that time period in which he was the CEO, or for instance, it would only relate to the time period for breach of fiduciary duty, or the claim against us, knowingly participating in a breach of fiduciary duty. Dr. Agarwal had to have a fiduciary duty. The only time he had that duty was when he was a CEO. And so when we're looking at the time period of when these allegations are, that's the only two claims, right, of which there's any communication from Mr. Davis to Mr. Agarwal, right? And so when we do this claim-by-claim analysis, I think that is important because we see that from a perspective of Mr. Davis, none of the allegations then were related to some tortious conduct that he was having. There is no specific allegations related to what Mr. Davis said or what he did in efforts to facilitate this. And I'll point out that those same exact types of conclusory allegations were also made against Marilyn Martin, who has been dismissed in this case. And she was actually an employee of Next Frontier. Who again also the court found did not have jurisdiction. I do want to walk through with the court that kind of last level of the analysis that I didn't talk about related to Murchison. And that's whether, even if the defendant does have minimum contacts, a Texas court must also consider whether exercising jurisdiction would be unfair. This is the additional hurdle for the plaintiffs to overcome here. We look first at the burden on the defendant. Mr. Davis has never visited or traveled to Texas in his individual capacity. Forcing Mr. Davis to depart from his professional and personal duties and obligations in Florida and his other offices in Martha's Vineyard, to depart personally and incur expenses to travel and litigate in Texas for an indefinite period of time away from his family when plaintiffs have really no legitimate reason for litigating in Texas. Right? Again, they aren't Texas residents. No one in this litigation is a Texas resident. We look at the Texas interest in adjudicating this dispute. Texas has minimal to no interest in adjudicating a dispute where none of the parties, including the plaintiffs, reside here or have substantial connections to the state. Alencia Spazzo versus Reed, because this dispute does not involve any Texas entity and cannot result in a judgment in favor of any Texas entity, we conclude that Texas' minimal interest in this dispute strongly mitigates against the assertion of jurisdiction in this case. The plaintiff's interest in obtaining relief in Texas, plaintiffs are not even allowed to litigate this case in Texas. They're not registered to do business here. And we cite to the business code 9.051 that would indicate that. And correctly identified in the brief, that's a capacity issue, not a jurisdictional issue. But it does go to the perspective that they never availed themselves to the state of Texas. They're not registered to do business here. Also, when we look at this jurisdiction, enforcing a judgment would be necessitate further legal action in other states and countries if we move forward with this. Again, there is no defendant who a judgment can be enforced in the state of Texas. Murchison is a Canadian company, and Mr. Davis is a Florida resident. The interstate judicial system's interest, and it appears that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Michael.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd again like to begin by clarifying four key points. First, Texas law and the U.S. Supreme Court precedent is clear that a plaintiff's residence is not an element that the court has to look at for establishing specific personal jurisdiction. So long as the defendant is sufficiently connected to Texas and the plaintiff's claims, that settles the matter. Second, we're arguing that Mr. Davis's own tortious conduct is what subjects him to jurisdiction here. We're not arguing that he's subject to jurisdiction because he's the officer of Panuvia Holdings. Quite the opposite. We're arguing that Mr. Davis's own tortious conduct strips him of the protective shield of that officer status and subjects him to jurisdiction and individual liability in Texas. Some of that alleged tortious conduct includes Mr. Davis's making misrepresentations to plaintiffs in Texas regarding the Panuvia acquisition, his making misrepresentations that the sham UCC sale would be terminated when it was not, his communicating with people in Texas, including Mr. Agarwal, in connection with the scheme to sell and reacquire the Texas property, and his playing an active role in repossessing that property. Third, This court's precedent is clear that physical presence in Texas is not required to establish specific personal jurisdiction. In cases like Bunting and Fisher, this court held that so long as a non-form defendant is participating and initiating in communications with individuals in Texas for the purpose of seeking a benefit in Texas, that's enough. That's exactly the case here, because Mr. Davis initiated and participated in dozens of communications that we know of with Mr. Agarwal, who was based in Texas, for the purpose of executing this scheme. That leads me to a related point, which is that there is certainly evidence that Mr. Davis had these communications with Mr. Agarwal. Again, we allege that he made these communications. We allege that he had multiple illicit meetings and virtual conferences with Mr. Agarwal and others in Texas in furtherance of this scheme. And then we proactively produced evidence, including Mr. Davis's admissions and discovery, where he disclosed at least 30 communications that he had with Mr. Davis throughout the relevant time frame.
What evidence do you have that his communications were illicit?
In the communications that he produced, or in the communications that he disclosed to us, many of them were WhatsApp messages between just Mr. Davis and Mr. Agarwal. And a lot of these were after we had specifically informed Mr. Davis that he was not to speak to Mr. Agarwal about debt or financing matters. So we have those communications. We also have late February emails, which are the only two communications that Mr. Davis attempted to address in his declaration, in which Mr. Davis and Mr. Agarwal and others who were involved in this scheme set up a secret virtual conference with the subject line Next Frontier. No one from Next Frontier that was authorized to be on that call was there. And then the next day, Mr. Agarwal sends a follow-up email to Mr. Davis saying, thank you so much for your time. Can you help us find a debt restructuring attorney? And this is after we told him that they're not allowed to talk to Agarwal about any type of debt or restructuring issues. So we produced that evidence, that coupled with the fact that he did not negate any of our allegations regarding the illicit nature of these communications, is more than sufficient at this stage to establish jurisdiction. And the final point that I wanted to touch on from Mr. Payne's argument was the focus on these choice of law and forum selection provisions. The U.S. Supreme Court and the Texas Supreme Court have said that those provisions are not dispositive of the specific personal jurisdiction analysis. Those provisions, while serving as consent to jurisdiction in one forum, don't dispositively show that jurisdiction anywhere else is improper. So those aren't dispositive here. I'll turn now just to the general personal jurisdiction framework and applying Mr. Davis's individual contacts to that. It's worth reemphasizing the way this burden-shifting framework works. Plaintiffs have the initial burden of pleading the allegations that are sufficient to invoke jurisdiction. That shifts the burden to Mr. Davis to then negate every pleaded basis of jurisdiction. If he fails to meet that burden, we have no obligation to present any evidence of our own. That was the case for most of the allegations here. Plaintiffs met their initial burden of pleading allegations to invoke personal jurisdiction. Again, we met this minimal burden simply by pleading that Mr. Davis had committed torts in Texas. But even if that allegation was insufficient, and it was not, plaintiffs pleaded numerous other allegations that showed that Mr. Davis engaged in tortious conduct in or connected to Texas that were sufficient to confer jurisdiction. For example, plaintiffs alleged that Mr. Davis made those misrepresentations to plaintiffs in Texas regarding the Benuvia acquisition, that he made the misrepresentations regarding the Sham UCC sale, that he reached out and traveled to Texas both to ensure that the Benuvia acquisition closed.
And can you again tell me what specifically was the misrepresentations or the more than one misrepresentation that Davis directed toward Texas?
Correct. So in the petition, we alleged three specific misrepresentations as to Mr. Davis. Now, those are not all-inclusive. Those are just the examples that we included in the petition. And those were misrepresentations that plaintiffs would be allowed to run Benuvia, that Mr. Davis and the other defendants would not discuss debt and financing matters with Mr. Agarwal, and that the UCC sale would be terminated before Mr. Davis participated in making sure it occurred. And that UCC sale, even though it was conducted in New York, it was substantially connected to Texas because the assets that were at issue there were the ownership interests in BMI and BT, so that by extension included the leasehold interest in the facilities and the interest in those facilities operations. So other specific allegations of tortious conduct and contacts with Texas that plaintiffs made for Davis, or Mr. Davis, are that he had these communications with Mr. Agarwal, and that he knew Mr. Agarwal was in Texas, reached out to him in Texas, and did so for the purpose of seeking a benefit in Texas, mainly taking BMI, BT, and these facilities for his own personal benefit. We further allege that Mr. Davis played an active role in repossessing that Texas property, and that his involvement in this scheme was all for his personal benefit, which takes him far out of this his corporate status as an officer. That more than satisfied our burden. Mr. Davis's arguments to the contrary are meritless.
And how does it benefit him if he's not an owner?
We alleged that Mr. Davis did all of this for his own personal benefit and enriching himself by taking Benuvia's assets for himself. Now that shifted the burden to Mr. Davis to negate that allegation, and he presented no evidence of that. So we never had to present additional evidence.
But are y'all saying not for Benuvia, that he didn't take the assets for Benuvia Holdings, that he actually took them for himself?
We are alleging personally? That he received a financial or other economic benefit by virtue of these actions. We also alleged that in this scheme, and one of the things that led to the default on the note, was Mr. Davis working with Mr. Agarwal to misappropriate corporate assets and pay unauthorized payments to Mr. Davis and to Canfilate. Now there's conflicting evidence in the record about which entity received the official payment, but we presented evidence that Mr. Davis was on the email authorizing those payments and that he was not supposed to be involved with that. So that connects him to the payments and confirms his personal benefit in the arrangement. The fact
but
that no
I guess I'm being confused when you're saying his personal benefit. The payments weren't to him, correct?
We allege that he did receive the payments, that they ultimately were funneled to him.
Funneled to him through the
through various entities.
Right. Okay.
Right. At this stage, though, the allegations that Mr. Davis participated in this tortious conduct for any benefit at all, whether that be him getting paid through his company or him getting paid directly, the fact that he is taking actions in Texas that constitute torts to benefit someone other than just a random corporation confirms that he purposefully availed himself of the privileges of doing business here. So all of that shifted the burden to Mr. Davis to negate each of these pleaded bases of jurisdiction. And again, Mr. Davis, like Murchison, failed to show that he didn't purposefully avail himself of the privileges of doing business here. Mr. Davis's special appearance declaration failed to address most of plaintiff's jurisdictional allegations against him. That included the allegations that Mr. Davis made misrepresentations to them in Texas regarding the Benuvia acquisition, that he initiated and participated in these tortious communications with Mr. Agarwal, that he participated in illicit meetings and virtual conferences with others in Texas in furtherance of this scheme, that he played a role in repossessing the Texas assets, and that he took those acts for his personal benefit. Mr. Davis's declaration also confirmed that he traveled to the Round Rock facilities roughly 7 times within the time frame where plaintiff's claims arose. Each of those allegations established that Mr. Davis purposefully availed himself of Texas. Under Texas law, it's well established that purposeful availment exists if a defendant initiates and engages in these communications with people in Texas to seek a benefit here. If a defendant visits Texas to meet with others regarding the transactions underlying the litigation, a defendant participates with others to repossess Texas property, a defendant seeks to reap the benefits of the Texas economy, and a defendant is a willing participant in a transaction involving Texas property. Mr. Davis's conduct satisfies each of those tests here. So Mr. Davis's failure to negate each and every one of these pleaded bases ends the analysis. Mr. Davis can't negate jurisdiction by urging that he was not physically present in Texas for that 8-month period in the middle of the scheme. Again, the communications with Mr. Agarwal occurred in that time frame when Mr. Davis claims that he was not in Texas. And talking on a claim-by-claim basis, we're not alleging that the misrepresentations regarding the UCC sale somehow fraudulently induced us into the contract. We're alleging that they made various misrepresentations throughout the entirety of this scheme, all of which are connected to the Round Rock facilities and those facilities' operations and these overarching transactions that are each sufficient to support jurisdiction. Texas law doesn't require us to have a certain number of misrepresentations to confer jurisdiction. The fact that a defendant engaged in tortious conduct here, even by making one misrepresentation, is sufficient to confer jurisdiction. So the trial court on the second prong of the minimum contacts analysis also properly held that each of plaintiff's claims arose from or related to Mr. Davis's contacts. As with the Merchantson appeal, the court again does not need to assess this issue on a claim-by-claim basis because Mr. Davis, like Merchantson, agreed that all of the claims in this suit, and I quote, relate to plaintiff's acquisition of pharmaceutical manufacturing assets. We know those manufacturing assets are the Round Rock facilities. So Mr. Davis's agreement that everything in this case arises from that transaction and the subsequent events settles the matter. But since Mr. Payne has spent some time walking through the claims, I'll walk through and just give a couple of examples of why these contacts are specifically related. On the fraud and misrepresentation claims, those claims arise from or relate to Mr. Davis's Texas contacts because the operative facts for these claims include what Mr. Davis said or did not say to plaintiffs regarding these Texas-centric transactions. The test for arise from or relate to is the Texas Supreme Court set the test for in Mokey Mac. And there it said, to arise from or relate to defendant's contacts, a claim just has to, the operative facts have to be connected to it. So here, when you're looking at these claims, the focus is on what has to be proven at trial in relation to that. And for these fraud and misrepresentation claims, it's all about what was said to plaintiffs regarding these Round Rock facilities and who would rent them and how this transaction would go about. And Mr. Davis made some of those misrepresentations in Texas physically. We weren't required to present evidence of that because the burden never shifted back to us. But we did present unrebutted evidence that Mr. Davis not only made at least 4 in-person trips to the Round Rock facilities in the lead up to the Benuvia acquisition, including the week it closed, but he also, in the July month, I think it was in July prior to the closing, he organized and virtually participated in a site visit that his team had arranged for plaintiffs to go to the Round Rock facilities. And there's emails between Mr. Davis and plaintiffs saying that he's going to call into these meetings so that he can discuss the acquisition with plaintiffs and give them his unique insight. So even if the burden had shifted to us, the trial court could have reasonably, that's more than legally and factually sufficient evidence to support an implicit finding that any misrepresentation or omission that was made to plaintiffs occurred then or at those subsequent meetings at the week of the closing. The same is true for plaintiffs' tortious interference claims and the conspiracy claims that are predicated on those. All of those likewise arise from Mr. Davis's contacts with Texas because the operative facts of those claims include Mr. Davis's involvement with these communications with Mr. Agarwal and the acts that he took throughout this scheme to aid in repossessing the facilities. Mr. Davis's arguments on that point largely echo those we've already touched on today. For example, his lead argument is that he wasn't physically present in Texas when these claims arose, so he can't be subjected to jurisdiction. But plaintiff's allegations that Mr. Davis initiated and participated in these communications regarding the acts giving rise to this claim are more than sufficient to support jurisdiction. Mr. Davis's failure to negate those allegations, much less address the vast majority of those communications, is dispositive. And plaintiff's presentation of unrebutted evidence that many of these communications did in fact occur further bolsters the propriety of the trial court's ruling. Now, there was a question earlier about the subject matter of these communications. The reason that we don't know exactly what was said in these communications is because they haven't been produced to us. So we produced the evidence that he had disclosed the communications, but we don't have the exact content of it. So we don't know exactly the extent of what was happening. We know that these were illicit communications and we know that they were unauthorized, but until Mr. Davis produces those to us, we don't have the full extent of it. But the fact that they occurred gave the trial court more than sufficient evidence to conclude that something fishy was going on here, and that supported our tort claims. Third, a similar analysis defeats Mr. Davis's attacks on plaintiff's knowing participation in breach of fiduciary duty claims. These claims all implicate plaintiff's allegations that Mr. Davis assisted Mr. Agarwal in his breaches of fiduciary duty in those months when he was Benuvia's CEO. We again have evidence that Mr. Davis was communicating with Mr. Agarwal outside of the official channels in that time, and Mr. Davis did not present evidence negating any of our allegations on this point. As a result, the trial court properly concluded that all of plaintiff's claims arose from or related to Mr. Davis's contacts with Texas, so he had the requisite minimum contacts. That brings us to the final step of the jurisdictional analysis, which again is the traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice. Because Mr. Davis had the requisite minimum contacts, it's important to note that he has to present a compelling case that this is a rare instance where the exercise of jurisdiction would be unreasonable and wouldn't comport with these traditional notions. Mr. Davis can't do so here. First, litigating this suit in Texas will not unreasonably burden Mr. Davis. Texas law is clear that distance alone is generally insufficient, and that's especially true when a defendant like Mr. Davis has admitted that he's repeatedly traveled to Texas for business. Here, Mr. Davis is an officer of Benuvia Holdings, and we did present evidence that he manages Benuvia Holdings, so he does have an interest in that entity. But he's also agreed that he's likely going to have to come to Texas in his capacity as an officer of that company for that ongoing litigation. Second, Texas has a significant interest in this case because it centers on Texas real property and these Texas operations. This case also involves torts committed within Texas. Third, Texas is a convenient and effective forum for plaintiffs. Again, although Mr. Davis doesn't believe that this case will be proceeding in Texas indefinitely, it is right now, and it makes sense and furthers judicial economy to hear the claims against these defendants in the same forum at the same time. Finally, on the last two prongs of the traditional notions analysis, the interstate judicial system's interest or substantive social policies, Mr. Davis has offered no valid explanation for how those factors favor hearing this case anywhere outside of Texas. His primary argument in the briefing was that Florida has a more significant interest in this because that's where he's from and that's where Benuvia Holdings is. But Benuvia Holdings, again, is in this litigation in Texas. And Texas is where all of the operative facts of this case occurred. So that's not a compelling reason to avoid jurisdiction based on that alone. As a result, Mr. Davis can't show that this is a rare case where exercising jurisdiction would be unreasonable. Plaintiffs thus request that the court affirm the trial court's denial of Mr. Davis's special appearance.
Did you agree, though, that if we were to affirm the trial court and leave and deny the special appearance, they would still be able to argue whether this was the correct venue, Texas was the correct venue or not?
Right. Under Texas law, I mean, as they agree today, capacity and forum are different issues, so the special appearance was not the proper vehicle for raising that. So we haven't addressed those issues yet in the trial court, but those could still be addressed. Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Payne?
May I proceed?
Yes.
The declaration of Mr. Davis, I think, is important here, and I just want to read a portion of that for the court. I've never traveled to Texas to meet with defendant Mr. Agarwal. In fact, I've never met Mr. Agarwal in person. With respect to any communications I had with Mr. Agarwal, I was unaware of his location at the time of these communications, unless he happened to volunteer such information during the conversation. Because his physical location bore no relevance to the subject matter of the communication, it was of no interest to me.
Just on that point, though, he didn't dispute the fact that there were seven visits in the relevant time period, nor the conversations with Dr. Agarwal.
So there are seven visits, and the visits, if we look at that claim-by-claim analysis, right, when the seven visits are. The visits during the time period in which the plaintiff owned these assets, he traveled to, and his affidavit goes through that. He made periodic visits to Texas. Those visits, and he goes through A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. and identifies the specific dates in which he came to Texas, what the purpose of those communications were, and what happened during those. Those are all corporate capacity. He says all of those things are related to his corporate capacity. The relevant time period in which there was no communication for Mr. Davis in Texas was that time period in January, February, March, April, May, all in this time period in which they're alleging that he conspired with Dr. Agrawal, that he was actually engaged in a tort in Texas. The reality is the testimony that's here is he was never in Texas during that time period. Dr. Agrawal, that time period that he owed a fiduciary duty as their CEO, the testimony is clear. He was never in Texas during that time period. Mr. Davis was never in Texas during the time period in which he was alleged to conspire with Dr. Agrawal. Same for his breach of fiduciary duty. Knowingly participating in helping Dr. Agrawal breach his fiduciary duty as the CEO, he was never in Texas during that time period. And so you would have to determine, contrary to what Mr. Davis has indicated here, my communications with him were not at all directed related to Texas. They were communications. And I want to go through, I think that Michiana Easy Living case was the telephone call case in Texas that I talked about. The telephone calls with a Texas resident from afar is insufficient to confer personal jurisdiction. Riverside Express Inc. versus B.R. Crane, finding the same logic that renders phone calls insufficient to confer jurisdiction over a non-resident in Texas applies equally to email communications. Rex Performance Products versus Betagoda, a proper minimum contacts analysis must look at the defendant's contacts with the forum state itself, not the defendant's contacts with a person who resides there. And in that case, finding, among other things, that negotiating a secret side deal via email between a resident and a non-resident was insufficient to exercise personal jurisdiction. These communications were not purposeful directed to Texas. There's no allegations that they're purposefully directed to Texas. There is this discussion about a payment. The payment did not go to Mr. Davis. It went to Benuvia. Moreover, the bank accounts in which the money was transferred from and transferred to, none of those accounts were based in Texas. This money wasn't in Texas. It didn't go to Texas. It never touched Texas. These were different bank accounts related to this alleged consulting fee that he improperly took. It didn't. It went to Benuvia Management. And that information has been provided in the underlying evidence.
What about the allegation that he was likely a beneficiary, whether or not that ultimately be proved? There is an allegation that Davis was to be a financial beneficiary of this alleged tortious conduct.
Again, as it would relate to what operative fact of their claim, right? The financial beneficiary of a company selling assets to another entity that then defaulted, that then we attempted to enter into a forbearance agreement with, which then they again defaulted, in which we then had to go back and do a UCC sale in New York. There's not a benefit there. There was a detriment. And so in this particular situation, there's no windfall. The allegations of damages here relate to their intentional interference with other business expectations where they would make more money. The fact is here, they failed to pay us the $26 million that they owed. We had to foreclose and go through a UCC sale in New York. And then we have an unpaid satisfied judgment for $26+ million. How that is alleged to have an individual in this case, Mr. Davis, who again did not sell, did not do anything other than his capacity as a in the company. He didn't benefit any way in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything else? Okay, thank you, Mr. Payne. At this time, we are going to submit 03240542 CV, Todd C. Davis versus Next Frontier Holdings, Inc. and Benuvia, Inc. Thank y'all very much. I appreciate y'all playing with us and doing all of this at once. I know it was a little bit long, but hopefully you'll have more time in the afternoon for other things. Thank y'all.